Ben Greenfield Fitness, episode 287. What is the best way to eat eggs? Gelatin versus collagen. Better sleep for new mothers. Foam rolling 101. Germs on water fountains and much more.
Welcome to the BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
So this week has been pretty cool workout-wise for me. How about for you?
Well, Brock, I'm quaking in my boots this morning because I've got, Wednesdays now are the day where I have my toughest workout of the week.
Quaking in your boots.
I'm quaking in my boots. That's the nice way to say crapping my pants.
Freaking out on the inside.
Anticipation of this afternoon's workout.
So what is it?
Well, I'm now down to about a month and a half before I shove off to California to go do the Kokoro Camp and Seal Fit Academy with Commander Mark Devine. Thanks. And Mark has guaranteed me that he's going to give me special treatment, meaning that they're going to focus on trying to break me as much as possible. So I'm now doing at least one...
That's not cool.
I'm now doing at least one Seal Fit WOD each week, what's called an operator WOD. And these are designed to kind of just make you a little bit more mentally and physically tough. And so today's workout is called Curtis. And the way that Curtis goes is I load up a barbell to 135 pounds. So not a ton of weight, but basically 45-pound weight plate on either side. Yeah. And then Curtis is 100 reps of a power clean up to my shoulders, rack it on my shoulders, and then left lunge. Basically a left reverse lunge to a right reverse lunge to a overhead push press. And I do that 100 times, and that's the workout.
Wow. Without stopping.
I will probably maybe get about 20 in, and then I'll break it into 10s, and then I'll break it into 5s, then 3s, then 2s, then 1s, then whatever it takes to get to 100. So there's
strength is going to be the issue.
Yeah, there's no way I could do it all at once. So yeah, that's today's fun.
Wow. Yeah, that definitely, there's a lot of physical issues with that, but mentally that's going to be really tough.
Yes. And whoever Curtis is, I'm sure that I will be cursing Curtis by this evening.
Well, that makes my workout seem like a sort of skipping through the daisies on a lovely spring morning. All I did was a whole bunch of plank exercises and some wall sits and some lunges and lunge jumps, and then went for a fast run.
You wuss.
News flashes.
Tons and tons of news flashes each and every day on twitter.com/BenGreenfield. And now we're going to show you the three best.
That's right. Put your propeller hats on because we're going to dig into a study. So today's study that we're going to talk about is from the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance. And this is one that I tweeted out over at twitter.com/BenGreenfield. And what I actually told you in that tweet was that you may actually want to run behind the person in front of you in your next triathlon or 5K or 10K or marathon.
Instead of running in front of the
Instead
person behind
in,
you?
In front of them. Of course, there is the exception that if they have gas or if they're doing the whole shotgun as they run, that may be...
It's not rockets.
Not to run behind them. However, this study actually looked into drafting and found that when you run close to the person behind you, you not only finish,
the
person in front of you, that's right. You draft off of them the same as you would draft off of someone on a bicycle. So you swimming. Not only they found that the runners were able to finish a 3,000 meter run, which is a significant amount of difference, in 9 minutes and 4 seconds versus 9 minutes and 13 seconds when they drafted off of a runner in front of them. And they also found that when they told them to rate how hard they worked on a 1 to 20 scale, even though they ran faster, they rated the drafting effort as a 13, whereas when they weren't drafting, it was rated as a 20. So basically, they ran faster at a lower rating of perceived exertion when they were running behind somebody. So maybe it's that the person was breaking the wind, not in the way that you'd think, but literally breaking the wind for them. Or it may be, and the researchers talk about this in the study, the fact that you're simply able to pace a little bit better when you're trying to keep up with the person in front of you. But ultimately kind of getting close up to the person who's in front of you and literally running with them almost step per step, just, you know, a couple of feet behind them, can actually be a pretty good strategy in a competitive running event or a triathlon or any other effort for which you want to keep up with somebody or lower your rating of perceived exertion or run faster.
And especially if you've got a killer headwind.
That's right.
That makes it more comfortable as well.
And speaking of running, I'm going to link to one of the funniest things that I've seen this week on the internets when it comes to running, and that is the oatmeal's do's and don'ts of running your first marathon.
Nice. Now, I love the oatmeal.
The oatmeal is one of my favorite websites for comics. It's at theoatmeal.com, and I'll link to this specific cartoon. But it's all of the do's and don'ts, and they're pretty funny, like this one. Do let those pre-race jitters fly. Start out at a completely impractical pace. This will demoralize other runners into quitting early, and you will be crowded marathon champion at mile 2. Let me
That's happened to me several times.
Here's a good one. Do delude yourself into thinking there's anything enjoyable about eating energy gels. And then it shows a guy eating an energy gel and saying, "This tastes like boob milk from a cyborg." Here's another good one that we'll all be able to empathize with if we've ever run a triathlon or a marathon or a 5K. Do not stop running when getting a drink at an aid station. By enduring the sprint choke, you could shave 3, possibly 4 seconds off your 5-plus-hour finish time. Marathon success does not come from training or perseverance. It comes from waterboarding yourself at aid stations. And I love what they say at the end. Here's a good one that we've all seen also. Do end on a high note. When you see the finish line, start sprinting like a coked out orangutan. No one will ever suspect that you jogged the previous 26 miles. I love it. And it goes on and on. There's a lot of really good ones in there. But if you want a good chuckle today, go check out the oatmeal's do's and don'ts. And we'll link to that over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/287.
We should probably give a little bit of a explicit warning. If you're easily offended by language, you may not want to go and see it. It's not super foul, but the oatmeal does get a little blue sometimes.
Yes, it does tend to have colorful language. So, and then finally, an interesting article to flip a complete 180 and delve back into science. Biohacksblog.com had a really interesting article on how something called resistance starch can not only help to kind of repopulate your gut flora and help to stabilize your appetite and slow blood sugar release. And we're talking about things like green bananas and potato starch and plantains and things of that nature. But it may actually also make you smarter. And the really? Reason for that, and this is going to get a little bit geeky, so my apologies in advance. Time to put our propeller hats back on and maybe even our white lab coats. And what's the thing that you put in your white lab coat pocket that makes you...
The pencil protector?
Yes,
pocket
the pencil, protector. The pocket protector. Let's put our pocket protectors on. So basically, butyrate is a short-chain fatty acid, and it's a short-chain fatty acid that gets increased in your gut when you consume these things like half-ripe bananas, you know, like green bananas, or like potato starch or potatoes that have been cooked and then cooled. And what happens is that butyrate inhibits something called histone deacetylase. That's HDAC, we'll abbreviate it as. And what that is that's an enzyme that has a specific action of removing acetyl groups from histones. So, and I warned you we were going to get geeky on this one.
I'm scratching my head.
But basically, in short, what that does is when that HDAC activity goes up, you get increased expression of what are called neuroplasticity genes in your brain, which are going to enhance your ability to learn and enhance cognitive performance. But there's also evidence that when you inhibit HDAC, there is reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease and the formation of a lot of these neurofibrillary tangles that can cause Alzheimer's. So what this means is that the consumption of resistant starches or the inclusion of resistant starches in the diet by increasing butyrate in the gut can actually make you smarter. Now, you can also if you don't like the gas that you may experience when you consume resistant starches, there are other things out there. And this article at biohacksblog.com that we'll link to in the show notes goes into them. But there are things like sodium butyrate and acetyl L-carnitine and some other things that you can actually get in supplemental form and perhaps experiment with to see if you notice an improvement in cognitive performance from this formation of butyrate in your gut. The other thing that you can get butyrate from, of course, is butter. So you can include some grass-fed butter in your diet as well. I'm personally a fan of kind of taking the natural approach, and you know, I eat small amounts of fiber throughout the day. I eat a lot of green vegetables. I do some potato starches and rice-based starches occasionally with dinner after a workout. But I'm not a huge fan of doing something unnatural. You know, like we talked about the potato diet last week. And sure, it's a biohack or whatever, but it's just one of those things that's just exhausting when it comes to trying to follow this strict diet to enhance cognitive performance versus just, say, working vegetable-based fibers and maybe a little bit of unripe fruit here and there into your diet. I think you can still get some pretty good butyrate and gut flora expression that can help with cognitive performance. So,
you know, unknowingly, I made myself a little bit of a thing like this for breakfast this morning. I chopped up a green banana, fried it up in some butter, some grass-fed butter, with a couple eggs.
That's a perfect example of a way that you could increase butyrate. You can increase or get a lot of the benefits of eggs, which we'll talk about later in this podcast when it comes to cognitive performance. And that's natural, right? You're not like
and delicious,
you know, cooking and cooling a potato and, you know, having five potatoes for breakfast or something like that. So, yeah, I love that. Green banana fried in butter with a little bit of eggs. Perfect. Thank you, Brock.
Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/benG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/benG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor. All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben.
Q&A. Hi Ben, how you doing? My name's Andrew and I'm a big fan of your podcasts and listen regularly in the UK. A quick question please regarding eggs and specifically the healthy cooking of eggs. I'm on a hypertrophy diet and eat 4 eggs every day for breakfast, usually fried in coconut oil. I prefer to eat my eggs scrambled, but I'm reading and hearing a lot that scrambling introduces oxygen, which in conjunction with the heat of cooking oxidizes the cholesterol, leaving free radicals detrimental to health. What are your views, please? All the best.
So first of all, we should probably address what is a hypertrophy diet?
A hypertrophy diet is a diet that I'm guessing is designed for hypertrophy.
So specifically targeting the growth of muscles.
The growth of muscle. That's right. So a muscle growth diet. And incidentally, not to put Andrew on the spot here, but I should note that you don't need to eat a high protein diet to build muscle.
No.
And there is zero evidence that eating anything more than 0.7 grams per pound of body weight of protein is going to help you build any additional amount of muscle. So what that means is once you exceed about 30% or so of your daily total calorie intake from protein, you're not going to get any extra muscle building effect, and you're probably just going to make your kidneys have to work a little bit harder to need to deal with all the metabolic byproduct of protein breakdown.
And I'm guessing that unless Andrew is like the size of Andre the Giant, he probably doesn't need 4 eggs every single day.
Well, maybe. I mean, it depends how much protein you're eating the rest of the day. If you're having fish with lunch and steak with dinner, then 4 eggs in the morning might be a little much. I personally have about 20 grams or so of whey protein with breakfast, you know, in my green smoothie. And so, you know, he's having a little bit more than that. He's probably having closer to 30, 35 grams from 4 eggs. But still, it kind of depends on your protein intake the rest of the day.
Good point.
But on to Andrew's question, what is the best way to eat eggs? I personally like to crack them against my head and let the yolk run down my face and then kind of lick it off my face as it runs down. I like to leave that stickiness on there for a little while too.
It's good for your hair, right here. Nice, if you crack it on the top of your head and just let it roll through your hair.
Shiny hair gives me that Pantene shampoo look as I shake my hair around in the morning.
Who needs mousse when you've got eggs in your hair?
Smile slyly at the camera. You like those eggs, don't you? The best way to eat eggs, first of all, as far as this oxidation of cholesterol in eggs, it doesn't harm eggs to scramble eggs or cook eggs. That does not oxidize the cholesterol in eggs. The reason that that has become a concern among folks who are setting up on eggs is the fact that it is possible to oxidize the cholesterol in eggs, but that happens when you powderize eggs. During commercial processing, when eggs get forced out of a tiny hole at high temperatures and high pressure to create the kind of powdered egg products that, say, like a cafeteria might use or a hotel might use, you know, like the actual powdered eggs. That is the type of process that will oxidize the cholesterol in eggs. It's highly unlikely that just heating eggs naturally during like a scrambling process is going to do much in terms of oxidation. Now, let's just say that lipid oxidation and damaging of the fats would occur when you subject something like an egg yolk to heat. Well, what you need to consider is that egg yolks have a lot of vitamin E in them. And vitamin E is there to prevent oxidation, and vitamin E is very good at preventing oxidation. So that's just a reason to, if you are going to eat eggs, get pastured eggs, because the yolks of pastured eggs have about four times the amount of vitamin E that you're going to find in standard egg yolks. So use a pastured egg. The vitamin E in that is going to help with oxidation anyways. And ultimately, don't worry too much. I like to cook my eggs on low to medium heat just to play things on the safe side anyways. But it's really the powdered egg products where, you know, eggs are getting spray dried and forced through tiny holes at obscenely high temperatures and pressures in factories to powderize them for processed foods. Like, that's where you have to worry about oxidation of cholesterol from eggs.
And then you have to worry about all the stuff that it's being mixed with when it's reconstituted as well.
Yep. Exactly.
Usually some kind of vegetable oil.
Yeah. So as far as eggs go, I'm definitely a fan of eggs. There are some people that think that they're allergic to eggs, first of all. And I think that in most cases, that's bull. And the reason for that is that they've done a study that found that anybody who took one of these popular IgG allergy tests and found that they were sensitive to eggs, and specifically that means that they tested positive for what's called the albumin-specific IgG level, which is the type of protein that you find in egg whites. Well, what they found was that every single subject that they put into this study tested positive for this IgG level for egg whites, whether they had active allergies, whether they had resolved egg allergies, or whether they had no egg allergies at all. And what the paper concluded was that IgG responses to egg whites are probably just a completely normal physiological response to a protein that you are frequently ingesting. So basically, if you eat eggs a lot, if you take one of these food allergy tests, it'll tell you that you're allergic to eggs. So the only time that you might not test positive to an IgG test for eggs would be if you just don't really eat eggs much at all. So the only thing that would convince me that someone who tested positive for an egg allergy was actually allergic to eggs was if it was accompanied by inflammation. So if you test, for example, C-reactive protein, or what's called hsCRP, or you test, there's another test that you can do for cytokines, inflammatory cytokines, or you get like acne or achy joints or a bunch of GI upset and bloating and all of these
or like
indicators.
Me when I was a little kid, if I got some egg whites, it would make my face swell up like a potato. Like you couldn't even see my eyes.
Yeah, and like my nephew has to go to the hospital if he eats eggs. Like that's an egg allergy. That's an egg intolerance. Just a basic blood test that tells you you've got allergens circulating in your bloodstream against egg whites. All that can mean is that you're just eating a lot of eggs, and that's not an issue. So first of all, as far as egg allergies go, I just wanted to mention that while we're talking about
eggs.
We
sort of went off topic there, but that's interesting. But
yeah. Yeah,
really
now,
what Andrew asked.
Eggs are extremely micronutrient dense. I'm a huge fan of eating them. As far as the best way to eat them, first of all, if you're going to scramble them or fry them, I wouldn't use coconut oil, especially if you're using a good extra virgin unrefined coconut oil, which is what I recommend, because coconut oil actually has a pretty low smoke point. We cook our eggs typically in an avocado oil. sometimes fat. In a little bit of butter or bacon fat, but that's actually much better than coconut oil. Another really good one that you can cook eggs in is macadamia oil or olive oil. Both of those also have higher smoke points than coconut oil. Now, I know coconut oil tastes fantastic. Yeah, not extra virgin olive oil, just regular olive oil. Right. So olive oil, macadamia nut oil, or avocado oil would all be better choices, or just bacon fat for cooking your eggs in. So I wouldn't use coconut oil if you're going to scramble it or fry it. Now, you can also simply drop an egg into a smoothie, and you can use a raw egg if you do something like that, and that's not that big of an issue. You've got a bigger risk of dying in a plane crash than you do of getting salmonella for a raw egg. And if you're really concerned about it, just rinse the outside of the egg before you crack it with a little bit of oregano or vinegar and water solution, because that's where a lot of the potential contaminants might be playing around, is on the outside of the egg, not the inside of the egg. Now, the other thing is that when you eat a raw egg white, you find a lot of information floating around out there that raw egg whites might bind the biotin, which is the valuable component that's found in egg yolk, and prevent the absorption of that. Well, biotin begins to break down as an egg is cooked. So if you're very worried about that, then don't eat the raw eggs. Just switch to cooking the eggs if you're really worried about biotin. But I wouldn't, it's not a huge concern of mine at all. Finally, what I should mention is that I've been seeing a lot of recipes out there for egg coffee. Have you seen this, Brock?
I have, yeah. Yeah, Mark Sisson had a good one.
Yeah, basically you take coffee and you mix it up. They recommend just mixing it up with egg yolks rather than the egg white, since the egg yolks is where most of the good micronutrients reside anyways. But basically, yeah, you make coffee and then you add scrambled egg yolks, like some cinnamon, some turmeric, some vanilla, a little bit of butter in there, and you just basically mix it all up. And you can throw that in a little blender and it makes like this frothy egg yolk mixture, but it's supposed to actually be pretty good. I haven't personally tried it. Have you?
I haven't. No, I've been tempted to, but I like mine cooked the way I like them.
Yeah. So scramble them, toss them raw in smoothies.
Make some ice cream out of it. Fry them. Coconut milk.
Yeah. Put them in coffee. Honestly, Andrew, I don't really care how you eat your eggs. I just wouldn't eat them powdered, and I'd choose something other than coconut oil to cook them in.
Hey, Ben and Brock, I'm trying to consider strategies for healing gut permeability besides bone broth, and I'm mainly wanting to compare three products. They're the Great Lakes Gelatin, Great Lakes Hydrolyzed Collagen, and Dave Asprey's Upgraded Collagen. So for the purpose of healing gut permeability, is it much better to take Great Lakes Gelatin or Great Lakes Hydrolyzed Collagen? What would be the differences here, if there are any? Also, Dave states that unlike gelatin, which is damaged by heat processing, his collagen leaves the peptides intact and provides more collagen than bone broth. Do you think that the upgraded collagen would provide much more of a benefit? Thanks for any help you guys can provide.
Well, you know what the ultimate question is here, Brock.
What's that?
Which is better for getting nice, supple lips if you're going to get plastic surgery, gelatin or collagen?
Yeah, the big kissable Angelina Jolie kind of lips.
I love those huge lips. Yeah.
Or sort of looks like a duck face all the time.
With the eggs dripping down your face, your big lips.
Gelatin versus collagen.
That was the most attractive moment of the entire podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
I think this is kind of confusing to some folks. So, first of all, the main difference when you look at gelatin versus collagen is just the processing. So we've talked about Great Lakes gelatin before, which is the brand of gelatin you can get off Amazon. It's got like the red label on it. And then they've also got Great Lakes has this one with a green label that's called just collagen. And you'll notice if you've used these that the collagen will tend to dissolve in even a cold liquid pretty easily. So you can mix it in drinks and shakes and smoothies or ice cream, or, you know, put a tablespoon pretty much anywhere and it dissolves and it doesn't clump or produce this gelatinized effect. Whereas gelatin, unless you're putting it into something hot, generally what happens is as soon as it cools down, it makes a jello-like effect. Hence why they call it gelatin.
Does it taste like strawberries?
E-L-L. Oh,
so does it taste like green?
From a qualitative standpoint, that's what they are. But basically, the difference is that when you're making collagen, let's look at Great Lakes, for example. So what Great Lakes does is they use grass-fed beef, and they actually source grass-fed beef hides for their raw material for their gelatin products. And the way that gelatin and collagen is made is you split the hides, and the hides is the area of an animal that's under the hair where all the collagen is. And I know this sounds really nasty, but for any of you who use collagen, whether it's Dave Asprey's upgraded collagen or Great Lakes collagen or whatever, that's where it's coming from. So if you're, if you're vegan or vegetarian, just know that it's an animal hide. And what happens is for something like Great Lakes gelatin, what they do is they put that hide into what's called an alkaline solution. And they keep it in there for a number of days, and that helps the material to get broken down into smaller pieces of skin, which is, again, kind of gross to think about. So now we've got all this animal skin, and it gets acid washed and then put in these little cooking kettles, and that separates the tallow from the skin from the collagen. And then what happens is they filter the collagen and they put it through what's called a vacuum evaporator. And that's actually a pretty delicate process. It's a little bit above 200 degrees that it goes through this vacuum evaporator. And then after the collagen evaporates, they actually put it through this sanitation process at about 240, 250 degrees to kill off any bacteria. And at that point, that is pure collagen. And then what they do from there is they'll take the collagen and they'll turn it into what's called collagen hydrolysate. And collagen hydrolysate gets heated to even higher temperatures with this process to reduce what's called the molecular weight. And that cleaves the amino acid bonds. That's called hydrolysis. So we're using water at a high temperature to cleave all these bonds. And then it's spray dried, just like the eggs we were talking about earlier, at really high temperatures and pressures to be made into a dry powder. Now, if you want to go on and you want to have it become gelatin instead of collagen, rather than putting it through that entire process that I just described, the hydrolysis and the cleaving and the spray drying, instead what happens is it gets sent into something called a votator. You ever heard of a votator before?
I have not.
A votator is one of the most commonly used food apparatuses in the U.S., and it's kind of standard equipment in a lot of food labs, and it's basically, it allows for something to emulsify and kind of agitates it. It's basically almost like a very fancy way to stir things up. So,
It's like one of those paint shakers?
Kind of similar. That kind of looks like that too. But basically what happens is the collagen gets sent to a votator. It's chilled, it's solidified, it's pumped onto a drying belt, and that's gelatin. So that's the difference between gelatin and hydrolysate. The primary difference being that collagen, rather than getting broken down via hydrolysis and heat and spray drying, it just gets cooled. So technically the gelatin undergoes a lot less processing than the hydrolysate. When we're looking at something like Great Lakes, for example, as a product, and when you're looking at something like the upgraded collagen, Dave Asprey's upgraded collagen, well, it actually is true that that stuff is it's more expensive, but it's a little bit healthier for you than the Great Lakes collagen hydrolysate, because the upgraded collagen is broken down via an enzymatic process. They use enzymes rather than using a high amount of heat in that process that I talked about for hydrolysis. So technically you get a product that has a little less oxidation and it's gone through a little less heat damaging. So you get a little bit better protein in that sense. And the whole reason that you'd want to use any of this stuff anyways is because of what we talked about in last week's podcast. You could go back and listen to podcast number 286, but we talked about glycine and how so many of the proteins that we eat these days, such as just basic meat from steak, it doesn't include the high amounts of glycine and lysine and proline that you get in collagen and gelatin and things like bone broth and bone marrow. And of course, if you can, you should eat bone broth or bone marrow as a staple of your diet rather than collagen or gelatin, just because it doesn't have any of the processing. It doesn't need to go through this enzymatic processing, hydrolysis, any amount of heating whatsoever, et cetera. But you can't exactly put a vat of bone broth into your luggage when you hop on a plane flight to Florida. And it is sometimes not something that you might be able to go out of your way to make on a Sunday evening. And so, you know, if you just need to throw something or stir something into your smoothie really quickly to allow for benefits for your hair or your skin or your muscle or your cartilage or your ligaments or your blood cells, all of which collagen can help with, that's where it can come in handy to just add a, you know, add some collagen powder, like some collagen hydrolysate powder to a smoothie or a shake. Or if you want to, you know, like my wife will make little popsicles and stuff for the kids using gelatin. So that's where these powders would come in handy. And I'd say, honestly, if you wanted to really choose the least processed form of collagen hydrolysate, go with upgraded collagen. If you don't want to go with that and you don't mind having the gelatin that clumps at lower temperatures, then get that Great Lakes unflavored gelatin stuff. And we'll put links to both of those in the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/287. But of course, I can't emphasize enough that the best thing that you can do for your body ultimately is to just make your own homemade bone broth. I think there's a website too where you can order bone broth. It's like I think it's thebrothery.com.
Yeah, something which, like that.
Yeah, to me that sounds like a porn site or something. Thebrothery.com. Let me check here.
Food porn, maybe.
Thebrothery.com. They ship anywhere in the continental United States, and it's homemade bone broth. So there you go.
Thebrothery.com.
Hi, Ben. My name is Jen. I had a baby at the end of May. He's 6 weeks old now. So you can imagine I am up every 3 hours feeding him, whether it's day or night. So I was wondering if there's anything I can do or supplements I can take to help the little sleep that I do get to be more restorative. And likewise, if there's anything I can do or take during the day to have more energy. I also have a 2-year-old, so taking naps while the baby naps is really not an option. Thanks for your help. Love the show.
Jen, just sleep. Children are very hardy. They will survive when left alone for long periods of time. You know, babies will actually, they'll become more tough, more resilient when you just leave them alone. So go get your sleep, lock yourself in your room, put your white noise app on, let your baby cry.
I am, if you're wondering what I'm doing, I'm phoning child services right now with the other hand.
Seriously, I am, even though I am definitely a fan of the whole like unstructured free play with kids, there is a serious amount of very valuable attachment that occurs when children are young, and you do need to get up and take care of them at multiple times, and it is exhausting. And the problem with, of course, being a new mother is that when you look at a lot of the, let's say, the hacks that we talk about in this podcast, like, you know, passion flower and magnesium and herbs and, you know, pulsed electromagnetic field therapy and all these things that you can do. Well, first of all, there is limited research on a lot of those things in breast milk and how much of that actually winds up in there. And for some of these hacks, like, you know, pulse electromagnetic fields and stuff like that, you know, not a lot of evidence on that type of thing and its effect on babies. Mm-hmm. So what I think that Jen should focus on are natural ways to get more sleep and have more energy. And I will put a link in the show notes to the 2-part article series that I've written on getting better sleep, beating insomnia, managing jet lag. I've written pretty extensively about that on the podcast. And I would definitely check that out if I were Jen. But a few of the things that that you can do just to ensure, you know, whether you're a new mom or not, if you just want to use natural means without, you know, pulling out supplements or fancy biohacks to get better sleep or to have more energy, I'll give you some of my best tips.
So this doesn't include Quaaludes and red wine then?
No. Damn. No benzodiazepines or Phenibut. By the way, have you ever tried Phenibut for sleep?
No.
Yeah.
I actually don't know what that is.
It's a sleep aid that's actually used a lot of times in military situations where you got to get quick periods of deep sleep, wake up, and be able to operate at a high capacity. And I actually experimented with it a couple of times this month. It's very interesting. You get this deep lucid dreaming and you wake up and you just like pop out of bed and you're good to go. The problem is it's highly addictive. And some people report beginning to experience significant mental disturbances during sleep at night, like disturbed lucid dreaming with long-term use. But I experimented a couple of times with about 500 milligrams of phenibut. And I did definitely sleep like a rock. It took about an hour or two before you get to bed at night. But careful with that stuff.
I want to try some of that hemp oil.
And Jen, don't take phenibut or feed it to your baby. Although hemp oil, that's another interesting one. Yeah, listen to the podcast that we did. If you're listening in, listen to the podcast that we did on hemp oil extract, not marijuana per se, with the mind altering effects of marijuana, which I don't have anything against. It's just, you know, something that may not
sometimes
be practical
you don't need
for,
it
for children or for new mothers. But check out that episode. It's interesting. So off that segue now, I'm back to Jen. Jen, some of the big tips I can give you. Get the room cool that you're sleeping in. The ideal range for the human body for adequate deep sleep is 65 to 70 degrees. That's one of the first things that I do when I travel and I want deep sleep. I walk into my hotel room and I turn down the temperature to 66. That's my perfect sleeping temp. And if it won't go lower than 66, I call downstairs and they send engineering up to adjust my my thermometer, because some hotels, just to save on money, will keep it from going lower than like 68 to 70. And it's just a quick fix. It's like a turn of the screwdriver and they make it able to go down lower than that. So I keep the room at 66 for nice, cool sleeping. The next thing is if you're able to use your bedroom for sleep and sex only, that's ideal. So eliminate TVs, laptops, electronics, clutter, all of that stuff. It's just basic sleep hygiene. And I know that this might sound like boring and easy stuff, but it does make a big, big difference when you make that decision not to take your laptop into your bedroom, or only to allow your phone in your bedroom if it's in airplane mode. It's those little things that add up when it comes to natural sleep and deeper amounts of sleep. Now, of course, Jen doesn't have to worry about alcohol and caffeine, but of course, both of those can affect sleep as well, or keep sleep from being more restorative. So be careful with that. Get yourself a nice, I like the Sleep Master sleep mask, because it covers both your ears and your eyes, keeps things completely dark. And you would put that on while you're asleep, Jen. And then when you have to get up and you need to take care of the baby or open the refrigerator or tool around with the lights on in the house, do two things. First of all, wear some blue light blocking glasses, easy to find on a website like Low Blue Lights or like the Gunnar glasses you can get off of the Gunnar website. There's any number of blue light blocking glasses that you can get. But then also consider, in your room or the light that you use as you're up and around during the night, using primarily light from the red light wave spectrum. So you can get red light bulbs, you can get red light flashlights, you can get infrared light therapy devices, things like this off of Amazon, and you can use those as the heat, or not the heat source, but the light source that you're using at night. And that's what I use. I've got a little red light bulb, cost me $10 off of Amazon, that I keep next to my bed at night. And when I need to get up during the night, use the bathroom, you know, need to get a few things done, I'm reading in my bed before I go to sleep at night, it's only red light. I don't have the light in my bedroom on at all. I just flip that little external red light on. And then if I need to get up and go into the kitchen where I don't have that red light, or I need to open the refrigerator to have my midnight snack of ice cream, I wear my blue light blocking glasses.
You don't carry a little candle with you, like Ebenezer Scrooge, shuffling along in your slippers?
That's right. No, I use the blue light glasses because those actually remove all the calories from the ice cream. I don't think people are aware of that, that little biohack. Okay,
little known fact.
A few other things that I'd recommend to you as far as sleep goes, little things like deep breathing or meditation, as well as journaling, all those little woo-woo things, those can definitely help relax you more quickly and get you into deep sleep more quickly. And so something as simple as closing your eyes and doing some box breathing, like a nice four count in, four count hold, four count out for a couple of minutes after you've gotten up and
box breathing does not involve a box, by the way.
No, it does. You do not need to sit inside of a little cardboard box as you do this.
Don't hold a box in front of your face or anything.
Yes, or anything like that. And then as far as energy goes during the day, a few of the just super duper natural things that you can do. One would be cold water. I'm a big fan of a huge glass of cold water when you wake up in the morning. And then if you need even if you aren't able to say like jump into a cold shower, splash cold water on your face, which are two great ways to get rid of lethargy or being groggy, you can just drink a big glass of ice cold water. And I'm a big fan of that for naturally boosting your energy. The other thing is sunlight or blue light exposure at some point during the day can help out quite a bit. So you can, just like you can get red light devices, you can get blue light devices that emit blue light at certain points throughout the day, such as in the morning when you get up. If you live in a gray area like Seattle or Portland or Siberia or Alaska or something
Winnipeg.
Like that. Or Winnipeg. And then the other thing that you could do is get out in the sunlight when you are up. Let's say you've gotten 4 hours of sleep because you've been up and down with the baby. You wake up, it's whatever. Let's say it's 6:30 a.m. You're tired, but you got to get on with your day. You got to take care of that 2 year old. You need to get up and get ready to take care of the baby once they wake up. Get out in the sunlight. Just go outside, stand out there in your bare feet for a few minutes as you drink your glass of cold water. And you can skip the coffee, you can skip the caffeine, skip the energy drinks, skip the smart drugs, and just use some of those natural techniques. And I know that we talk about the herbs and the drugs and the electronics and stuff like that on this podcast, but I mean some of those things, just keeping the room cool, relaxing, de-stressing, having good sleep hygiene, drinking some cold water, getting some sunlight exposure. Those are some natural ways that you can get better sleep and have more energy. And those are great too, because they're not going to affect your kids. They're not going to affect your breast milk. So those are some of the things that I do.
Hey, Ben, I have a question. I have a new personal trainer and he's suggesting I use the foam roller thing, and it hurts when I foam roll, but he says that after a while it won't hurt anymore and the benefit will outweigh the pain I'm going through from rolling with the foam roller. So I wanted your opinion on it. Thank you.
Joe, it does get easier.
It does get easier, Joe.
It really, really does. It gets worse before it gets easier.
Yeah.
Before it gets better. It'll get better.
It'll hurt like a mother before it gets easier, Joe.
You look like an idiot while you're getting used to it too, because you're spazzing out on the floor, falling off your foam roller.
Yeah, as you grimace and hump that foam roller. So foam rolling is something that I personally do at least twice a week. Brock is one of the athletes that I coach. He knows that foam rolling appears as a requirement on his schedule at least a couple of times a week. Mm-hmm. And that's typically a full body foam rolling session. We don't even mess around with those sissy foam rollers that you see at the gym. We go straight to this one called the Rumble Roller, which has all these sharp, pointy ridges coming off it, which just make it all the more masochistic.
It's actually made of iron. It's not foam at all. It's an iron roller.
Yeah, and if you push the little button on the side, little needles come out of the ridges just to enhance that effect, make you all the more tough. So basically, it starts with trigger points. Trigger points are these knots that form in your muscles. And a common example of that would be like your IT band on the outside of your leg. If you have a trigger point in that muscle and you're foam rolling your IT band, it causes this pain and discomfort to kind of radiate up your hip or even all the way down your leg while you're rolling. You know, it'll sometimes radiate literally like down to your feet. And the reason that you're doing the foam rolling is to get rid of a lot of these trigger points, to release them. Now, when you just stretch, that doesn't release muscle tightness. It doesn't release trigger points. And if you imagine like a rope with a knot tied into it, and then you stretch that rope, all it does is it creates tension and it makes that knot even tighter. So what foam rolling does is it breaks up muscle knots with direct pressure and with direct tension. So you get it resumes basic normal blood flow, oxygen delivery, nutrient delivery that would normally be interrupted to muscle tissue, as well as allowing for increased range of motion that you normally wouldn't get because of the formation of those knots. So when you compress something, it's basically just like tenderizing meat, just like taking out a steak and hitting it with a hammer, rolling it with a rolling pin. It's going to be more tender and more supple. But that process does hurt because trigger points are these knotted areas of connective tissue and fascial adhesions, and there's nerve fibers that are getting hit, and there's, you know, pressure. Your body your body interprets pressure in a very similar way as it interprets pain. These nociceptors are stimulated along with pressure receptors in very similar ways. So you can feel pain and pressure as the same sensation often. And so, you know, the more foam rolling that you do, and this is going to sound really simple, but the fewer trigger points you're going to have, the more connective tissue suppleness you're going to have, and the less it's going to hurt as time goes on. But you will have periods of time that you go through in your life where no matter how much you foam roll, you'll finish a long run and you're going to have fascial adhesions, you're going to have knots, you're going to have trigger points that simply are going to hurt no matter what. And I have certain areas of my body that I know, even though I foam roll twice a week, if I've done a tough workout, they're always going to hurt. Usually it's the outside of my hips, my piriformis on the front of my leg a little bit, sometimes the underside of my armpit if I've been swimming a lot. But
it's not even a hard workout. Like after a day of sitting at a desk working on a computer, it really hurts to roll out my shoulders and my neck.
Yep, exactly. And you also need to consider that this is something that you need to be in for the long run, because it can take literally a year and a half to 2 years to realign connective tissue and realign fascia. That's why, for example, if you start weight training and you stop your weight training program or you stop certain exercises, you're never going to get very good at those specific movements, especially things like deadlifts and squats and overhead presses. You have to have done those consistently in your workout routine for a year and a half or two before your body actually starts to become extremely efficient at those movements. And it's the same with something like fascial adhesions or fascial quality. It takes a long time for fascia to realign. And the longer you've been beating up your body with things like running or cycling or poor posture on your computer at work, the longer it's going to take to realign and retrain that fascia. So foam rolling is something that you'll be in for the long haul, but yes, it eventually does start to get a little bit easier to move over and around a foam roller, and eventually the general pain and general hurt the whole time is replaced by a little bit more of a therapeutic feeling with a few little grimaces here and there as you hit certain knots. So ultimately what I do, if you go to youtube.com/BenGreenfieldFitness, you will be able to type in foam roller, and you'll see some of my key foam rolling exercises, me demonstrating them, the specific moves that I like to do as kind of like staples in my program. So, you know, my protocol is pretty much I foam roll twice a week for 15 to 20 minutes. When I travel with a lacrosse ball. And because I travel about 1 to 2 weeks for any given month, I will use that period of time to hit deeper areas or areas that the foam roller can't get. And then when I get back home, I get back into the foam rolling practice. But I just use basically those two methods of deep tissue therapy. The reason it hurts is because you're releasing fascia and you're hitting some of those knots, and it does get easier.
This is KJ from NJ. What is more sanitary, the water fountain or the water faucet at the gym? I've heard a lot of people say you shouldn't drink out of the water fountain. And I'm wondering if I were to use the water from the water faucet in the locker room, whether that would be better from a sanitation standpoint. Love your show. Look forward to your reply. Thanks.
KJ is definitely one of those guys who doesn't put his mouth right on the water fountain, I'm guessing.
I do. I literally get right down to that water. Sweet, I like I like the metallic taste.
I like to pretend it's a nipple.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a little messed up. There may be some Freudian issues going on there that you need to work out.
I shouldn't have said that.
So they've actually looked at the sanitation and the amounts of bacteria on water fountains and come up with some shocking amounts of bacteria, like more bacteria than the surface of a toilet seat when you're looking at like the spigot of some of these fountains. So What they actually did in one study was back in 2005, the National Sanitation Foundation tested various areas around two different elementary schools for bacteria content. And they found that the most bacteria-laden area in the entire school wasn't the bathroom, but the water fountain. So the water fountain had 2.7 million bacteria cells per square inch, which was like thousands more than any other area they tested. And that came in number one. A toilet, incidentally, came in number eight. I'm not sure what all was in between the water fountain and the toilet. I'm sure maybe other children or books or the floor were probably mixed in there somewhere. But ultimately, water fountain ruled as number one. And then there was a more informal study that kind of hit the news a few years ago. This was actually back in 2007, where this elementary school student tested four different water fountains and one toilet around the school using cotton swabs and petri dishes. And it kind of backed up the results from the National Sanitation Foundation. It showed that the fountains had way more bacteria than the toilets, and the toilets were actually surprisingly clean. So then there was one other study that was done where they looked at supermarkets and looked at the floors of supermarkets, and they also tested parks and park sandboxes. And what they found was that water fountains in both parks as well as supermarkets had more bacteria than the floors in these sandboxes. So the interesting thing here is that when you look at the actual water itself and you test the water coming out of the fountain, it's relatively free of bacteria because the water comes out of that spout in like this arc, and that prevents it from actually touching the spigot. When you look at a water cooler where the water goes straight down, and they've tested the water from water coolers, that actually has a higher bacterial content because typically people put their water bottles or their glasses right up against that spigot, which is pouring downwards and is actually probably cleaned less than the spigot of a water fountain. And you get the most bacteria in the actual water that you're drinking from like an office water cooler than you would from like an upward spouting water fountain. So ultimately, I drink from the water fountain at the gym. I don't use that little water cooler that pours down into my water bottle that a lot of gyms have nowadays. I use the water fountain. I don't wrap my mouth around the metallic spigot. I make sure I let the water run for about 5 seconds before I start to drink from the spout of water that's coming out. And ultimately, like, I don't worry about it too much. You know, there is this whole healthy hygiene hypothesis too, to where if we live life in a bubble, we're never getting exposed to bacteria and our immune systems are never going to develop. But ultimately, even the water fountains do have a lot of germs on them. The actual water itself is not that big of a deal. And you know what's more annoying to me? This is like my pet peeve at the water. So we've got two water fountains at our gym. We've got the normal one and the one that's low. Like the one that's kind of sort of for
kids.
I don't know, for kids or short people or whatever. And I will walk up to the water fountain and there will be a line of people waiting for the water fountain that's at normal height. And nobody wants to bend down. reminder, this is at the freaking gym. Yeah. Nobody wants to bend down and drink from the short water fountain. Nobody wants to squat down at the gym and drink from the lower water fountain. So it's always like go up to
the
water fountain.
Elevator at the gym.
Yeah, it's nuts. That's my big pet peeve. I'm just like, or I'll be drinking from the tall water fountain because I'll walk up, and if I have a choice, I'll go for the tall one if there's nobody in line there. And people will start to stand up in line behind me and give me these looks like, hurry up, when the short water fountain is sitting right there. So yeah, it's my pet peeve. It's my rant for the day. Drink from the short fountain, people.
I get way more angry with the people who push the handicapped wheelchair button on the doors.
Yeah.
When they're clearly not handicapped or have any issues at all. That's the ultimate lazy move.
That too. Although I do
ashamed of themselves.
I use the handicap bathroom at airports because I go into those bathrooms and
squat.
I do workouts in them.
Yeah.
I am that guy who is using the handicap bathroom for workouts. And
I think that's okay as long as there's no handicap people waiting.
Like, there has been one
crossing
time
their legs and dancing.
where I walked out of the bathroom after doing my push-ups and my squats and my jumping jacks, and there was a lady there with her two kids in the stroller crying, giving me this really annoyed look as I came out of the bathroom and was obviously a young, fit dude using the handicapped bathroom at the airport. And I felt bad for a little while, but I still do it.
I'm sure you and the lady both got over it quite quickly.
Yes.
And anyway,
speaking of the handicapped bathroom at airports, we have swag to give out for people.
Yes, and that's very relative. I
have no clue how that Sedgway actually works. But
by the way, we got two emails now wanting to correct you. It's pronounced Sedgway.
Sedgway. What did I say?
Sedgway.
That's because I read. I don't actually talk to people. I just read. So I pronounce words in my head. For the longest time when I was reading, I would read the word misled as misled. And I talked to people when I was in high school for the longest time. I would use this word misled. I'd be like, he totally misled us. Like, what do you mean misled? And eventually I learned that it is actually pronounced misled. But that's how bad I am with reading words versus saying them.
This is the danger of being antisocial.
Okay. So segue. First of all, gear. You can support this podcast if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/gear. And for $47, you get this awesome tech t-shirt that's not this big cotton tent, but an actual cool exercise t-shirt that looks good on you. It makes your body look better. You actually don't need to exercise, by the way, if you wear the Ben Greenfield Fitness t-shirt. You just put on the t-shirt. And
it's extremely slimming.
Exactly. You can put on the t-shirt over a bikini, and people will tell you you have an awesome body. It even does that. So you also get a guilt-free, BPA-free Ben Greenfield Fitness water bottle that you can drink eggs from, and you get a sweet beanie. We bypassed the hat, and we went straight to the beanie, which looks awesome.
Which you can store eggs in.
That's right. So you can get all that over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/gear and support the show when you do that. And it does indeed support the show. We got to pay for bandwidth. We got to pay for hosting fees. And for $47, you get that pack. And you get awesome swag and you support the show. But you also can get free swag just sent to you if you leave a review on iTunes and we read your review on the podcast. So we have some swag to give away right now to somebody who left us a review on iTunes. So you want to dig in, Brock?
Yeah, it's an incredibly short but sweet review this week by Peggle Pack. Peggle Pack says,
I almost named one of my kids Peggle Pack. My wife calls me Peggle Pack.
Come here, Peggle Pack. Anyway, very informative podcast. I really like how he takes the time to create a special web page for each podcast with links, notes, and Q&A answers.
Yeah. Well, Brock and I actually tag team that. I'd like to take all the credit for that. But you know what? That's what a lot of people, I think, if you're listening in, you may not realize this, but we go through painstakingly long efforts to create enormously helpful show notes for you. And we link to each of those show notes with the number for the podcast. So like right now, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/287, I've got everything from some of the collagen links to the foam roller to my two-part series on getting better sleep to all the studies that we talked about to the cartoon on running. Like, we let you be super lazy. You just go there and click away. Just click, 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 click.
Just click until your heart's content.
Clicking frenzy. And that's all over on the show notes. So,
and what's even better, if you wait a couple of weeks after the show has been around for a while, you can go to those same show notes and click on a link to a transcript of everything that we said.
That's right. We take care of you, our valued listeners. So check that out. And thank you, Peggle Pack. Email Ben at bengreenfieldfitness.com and we'll get a pack of swag out for you to
pack. Peggle Pack of swag.
Pack along with your Peggles. I pack an impressive Peggle myself.
As long as they're gluten-free Peggles.
That's right. So the last thing that I wanted to mention other than that is I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but I'm going to mention it again because it's a podcast I've been digging quite a bit recently. I don't talk about a lot of other podcasts on this show because, of course, ours is the best. But there's another podcast that's a close second. It's my friend Jordan's Art of Charm podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just about seducing women, although yeah, I'm sure that you could probably find a little bit of information on there about seducing women. Sorry.
And seducing men.
My apologies to the ladies listening in. I'm kind of joking. It actually doesn't have any of that kind of stuff on it at all, despite the name. It's about how both men and women can be more charming. And it's got a bunch of resources and practical tips and drills to do things like manage relationships and network and take your life to the next level in pretty much every area, except for health. That's where I come in. So go check out the Art of Charm podcast. It's somewhere on iTunes. I'll let you take it from there, but I'll bet you can hunt it down with the information I've just given you. So Art of Charm, check that out and go have some eggs.
Definitely. I need some eggs.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.